What have you heard?
Well, I heard, I need to explain the whole thing. It's a story about a dog I was working with.
Let's do it.
Very, very, very difficult dog.
Well, do you want to save it for the...
Let's do it.
Do it now?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, before the recording?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, well, it's all on, so let's go.
Oh, we're going?
Yeah, yeah.
We're live, Neil.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I had gone to work with this little dog in Newry, and the lady there had... Well, she's still recovering from cancer, and her husband had a heart condition. And they were lovely people. But at the end of the session, it was about 2 hours of working with her dog, I noticed all these little angel things all around the room and out in the garden. And I said to her, I'm not being shaky here or anything, but what's all the wee angels about? Oh, son, she says, son, like, at me the age I am. But anyway, she says, oh, son, she says, do you not believe in your guardian angel? And I says, no, not really. Well, she says, you have a guardian. He's standing there behind you. And she says, see, the next time you're in trouble, you just say to your guardian angel, whatever God's will is for me, will you help me here? Yeah. And you watch what happens. Right, whatever. Thank you very much. That's brilliant. Thank you. 3 weeks later, I was working with this dog in a different part of Newry. And it was a German Shepherd mixed with a collie, and it couldn't be put on a lead. Hadn't been on a lead for 3 years. Put a lead near it, it went mental. And when I arrived, didn't the farmer man who owned the dog tie it to a garden chair? And the poor dog freaked, broke the leg off the chair and away over the fields with it. So he eventually managed to get it and bring it back. And he says, here you are, and swore away and on. He says, take the effing thing and see if you, what you could do with it. So I picked this dog up and walked it to the end of their drive, put it down on the ground. I thought, right, I have 40 years working with dogs. I know I can sort this. Mm. So I'm working away with this dog. It started to dig a hole in the tarmac. It started to vomit. It peed itself. Then it came up the lead trying to bite me. And I thought, shit, I don't know what to do with this dog. And I remembered this wee woman. So I thought, right, okay. And I said, well, if you're there, I need a hand because I don't know what to do here. And as clear as a bell, I heard in my left ear, I heard, stand still. That's all I heard. And I stopped everything, stood there motionless. And all of a sudden, this wee dog stopped trembling, stood quietly beside me, and I took a wee step. She took a wee step, another one, another. 20 minutes later, wagging her tail, wow. Walking beside me.
Wow.
All the way through my 5.5 years doing my PhD at Queen's, every time I came to an obstacle, I did exactly the same thing. I don't know what to do here. What's the answer? And within an hour, the answer would come. I've had more experiences that are even more stunning than that. But that was one of my most recent experiences.
Wow.
Wow.
Yep.
And you know, whether you believe in God or the universe or whatever, if you hand over the fact that you're finite, you know, we're all dependent in some way, and you just say, look, I can't deal with this. Show me the way forward. Whatever you believe in will show you the way forward if you throw it open to them.
Love that.
Epic.
I love that. Hand over the fact that you're finite. I love that.
Yes, yeah. I believe. And you're weak. We're all weak.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all need something else outside of ourselves. No one is an island, as they always say. Mm. And it's true. Mm. It's absolutely true. And the older I get, the more I become aware of that, how much we depend. And also the fact that, you know, it's like going down a stream. Life is like a stream or a river. And you meet these little eddies here and there. Mm. And these little bits of wood or whatever swirl around. And these are actually people. And they coincide with your life for a brief period of time. You help each other mutually in one way or other. And then you move on. I found that all the way through.
Mm. Incredible.
Mm. The ripples, yeah. Love it.
Well, Neil, welcome to the show. Good to have you. That's
Thank
a good opener,
much.
I think.
We've started.
Thank you.
We're calling this series Wild Wisdom. Mm. I met Si a couple of months ago. Si, big Si Kelly, good to see you, bro. Rocking the producer today, rocking the co-host chair. Yeah, making the multicam action work. And I'm really curious about your story. You know, you're the author of this great book, Search Dogs and Me. We'll definitely plug it a few times throughout the show. For anyone who hasn't read it or picked it up, definitely recommend that. I really don't know how to describe you, right? I think we were kind of talking before, it's like dog trainer. We're like, Dog trainer seems a bit weak for the CV. So we'll get into it, but, you know, needs trained dogs for search and rescue, drug detection, disaster relief, optical detection, whatever that means. We'll get into that later on. He's traveled all around the world. He's saved lives. He's recovered bodies. He's worked with all kinds of dogs in all sorts of places. But I want to start. How did you guys meet? Because this is how Neil's here. How did you meet, Si?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
So I contacted you.
Did you DM him? Did you slide in?
I did. I contacted you because how much of this story can I share? Very carefully.
Why are all your stories classified?
I meet some wonderful people. So I'm on a plane in the States. I'm on a national flight where I am flying. I think I'm flying from...
an undisclosed location.
Undisclosed location. That's the best way. I get up. Plane lands, I get up, grab my bags, and all of a sudden there's a dog behind me. And the dog's wearing a red jacket. And I'm thinking, oh crap, what's happening? What's going on? There's a dog on the plane, they found something they're doing. And the guy just read me like a book and just goes, calm down. He's been under your seat the entire time.
Oh.
And I was like, really? Yeah, this humongous, I can't even describe the dog for classification. This big dog was under my seat the whole time. So I get talking to this guy because I love just talking to strangers, as you know. And I go down to baggage handling with him, and we've talked the entire way. I'm hearing his life story and how amazing this guy is. And I'm like, I need to film this guy. I need to get his story. I need to get details from this guy. He said, you want to talk to somebody? You got to talk to Neil Powell. And I was like, who's Neil Powell? And he goes, well, Neil Powell had a big hand in what we've been able to do with this dog. I think it's the best way to put it. And a very special dog. And I said, right, well, where is Neil Powell in the world? And he's like, well, he's in Newcastle. I said, oh, England. Yeah, okay, fair enough. He goes, no. Newcastle, County Down, Northern Ireland. And I was thinking, that's like 20 minutes from my house. Who's this guy? So that's when I thought, right, I've got to contact you. So that's the beginning of our relationship. And you'll find that I refer to Neil as Young Neil.
Yeah, whenever you phoned him earlier, I saw that. Yeah,
Young Neil.
What?
Young Neil.
Oh, yeah.
Because throughout his book... Yeah. Throughout his book, Neil is referred to, he's talked to by other people in the book as well, Young Neil. And so that's why I was calling him Young Neil.
Were you always around people that were older than you?
That's a very good question. Yes, not really. No, I don't suppose so. No, I wasn't really, no.
Why the Young Neil?
Why were they all calling Young Neil?
Well, I don't know. I sort of maybe a bit of a lunatic maybe, and, you know, give this... people the idea that this guy needs a bit of guidance. I don't really know, but I was always called Young Neil by the doggy man. I suppose it's kind of an indirect compliment in the sense that
it's a term of endearment.
You're a young student, like you're learning from me, you know.
But, young Palawan vibes, isn't it?
That's it, yeah.
But like some of the guys that I've met in the dog world, well, like there are three actually, but have been fantastic guys. Like, you know, I've learned an awful lot. I mean, anything I've learned, it's been passed on.
What can you tell us about the ancient connection between man and dog?
The ancient connection?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, that there. Yeah. My first dog was actually a cat called Tanky. I begged my father for a dog when I was 8 years old, and he got me a cat. But anyway, wow. I eventually got this little dog called Trixie, and she was a Cairn Terrier. And I wanted a German Shepherd, but I ended up with a Cairn Terrier, and I adored her. And I got her when I was about 10 years old. And she and I had a very, very close relationship. And I was away when I was 18. I decided to go and study for the priesthood, and so. Did that. I went down to Kilkenny, and I had to leave Trixie behind, obviously. And so one night I had this horrible dream that Trixie had been knocked down. I could see her being knocked down. I could see her being carried to the vets. I could see her with tubes coming out of her, the whole monitor thing going, all that. And I woke up in a absolute bog of sweat at about 5 a.m. I ran down the stairs in the dormitories where we were in the seminary, and I rang my ma. I'm from Cork originally. I said, Mom, what happened to Trixie? And she says, in the name of God, why are you ringing me at this time in the morning? there's nothing wrong with her. What made you think there's anything wrong with her? I said, Mom, I saw it all last night in my dream. I saw her being knocked down, everything. No, boy, she's grand. Are you sure? Yeah. And that was it. So a week later, my mate, Chris Craig, who's from Belfast, who'd had his appendix out, he landed back in the seminary. And I said, oh, Chris, good to see you back. He says, before you go any further, how the hell did you know that Trixie had been knocked down? I said, she wasn't. I thought she was. And he said, no, she was. It was exactly as you described it. And she was in the vets. And she was on the Ormo Road in the vets. How did you know that? I didn't know what I dreamt at all, my master. No, he said, it was exactly as you saw it. Now, how do you explain that? But that was the relationship that I had with that little dog. You know, she was astonishing. Like, I had another one.
Sorry.
Huh?
There's a lot. There's an awful lot there in what you just said.
It really.
And the story that you shared at the start.
Hmm? Yeah. Go on, sorry. Just what you were saying, the question you asked about the connection between man and dog. I think that's.
Yeah. And then recently, my little dog, Fern, who was 18 and a half, I had to get her put to sleep and it broke my heart.
Is she gone?
It was awful. But Fern, when she came to me, was going to be put down with a guy who had her before me because he couldn't get her to come back. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with her. She was only 8 months old, little black and white sprocker, Cocker Spaniel Springer Cross. And I said, there's no way you're doing that to her. I'm taking her home. And within 2 weeks, I had her coming back to me. Mm-hmm. So she was trained to find bodies. And her first task, so she was trying to find bodies whilst working on a boat. So when people are drowned, the scent comes to the surface and I trained her to find that scent, you see. And the very first task she had was two kids in Castlewellan Lake, Claire Steele and Rory McLendon. And the two kids had a tragic accident in the lake whilst in the canoe and the thing turned over and they were lost. Anyway, Fern had them found in 10 minutes. Anyway, in her last year, she took two strokes and she was incontinent, she was blind and she was deaf. And I nursed her for a year, right? Washed her wee bum every day, 2 or 3 times a day, all that. Came to the part where the vet said to me, look, Neil, you'll have to put her to sleep. It's not fair to her. She's in pain now. So I got her put to sleep. And 2 days after I did that, it was brokenhearted, absolutely. And I went into this wee coffee shop in Castlewellan that they know me. I came out of Mass and I went in there. And the girl says, ah, Neil, how are you? Saw on Facebook about wee Fern. And I couldn't talk to them. I said, look, I'll come back in. I went back out, sat in my car with the keys in my pocket, thinking about Fern, the tears run down my face. And all of a sudden, the four windows in my two doors, front and back door, all dropped with a big bang into the door. And the sunroof banged open. Two big bangs. I thought, what the hell was that? So the windows are all open, the sunroof is open. And all of a sudden I thought, that's the wee woman telling me, it's okay, let me go. And that was it.
Wow.
I immediately felt better for that. Now how, my granddaughter said, she says you press your keys accidentally and that's what happens when you do that. Even if the keys were in my pocket, I know I didn't touch them, but even if I did, why then, when I was totally distraught, did that happen? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you have a spiritual upbringing?
Well, my mother, I'm a Catholic. I was brought up Catholic. My mother was very devout. Yeah. And when we were kids, started off in Cork, but then my dad was in the Royal Navy, so we ended up in Cornwall. Living on the way out in the wilds of Bodmin Moor, and we couldn't go to Mass or anything like that. So my mother would make us say our prayers and we'll do all this here on a Sunday and all. But that was the height of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't fanatics or anything like that. And in fact, when I came to Northern Ireland first, I would have been 9 years old, I think, 8 or 9 years old. Somebody in the street said to me, what sort of an accent have you got? And I had a Cork accent. And so that didn't go down well. And then they said to me, what are you? And I said, what do you mean? I'm a boy. What do you mean? Don't be funny with me, mate, and all this. I went into my mom. I said, Mom, what am I? And she said, well, who asked you that? a wee fella out there. And she says, well, I suppose you're a boy. That's all you need to know. And she says, I suppose they're asking you what religion you are. She says, and I never heard of Catholic before.
Yeah.
So she said, you're a Catholic. And that was my introduction to Northern Ireland.
The difference, yeah,
I had never heard of it before.
What was your... Go ahead.
I was going to say, so what point did you decide seminary? What made you?
When I was about 12, I suppose, I thought to myself, I was used to serve in the altar and that, you know, and I wouldn't be religious or anything like that, but I just had this strong feeling that I needed to go and study for the priesthood.
Wow.
But I also had this strong feeling I wanted to go to sea. Mm. Like my dad, right, and my granddad, and my great-grandfather and all that. So I ended up going to, so I passed my 11 plus at the time, and I had a choice then of going to St. Malachy's College in Belfast or wherever I wanted. So I decided to go to Carrick Tech. I wanted to go to Carrick Tech and do engineering, and I was going to go to sea. And I ended up in at Glasgow at Stow College of Engineering, living in a tenement place in Stow College. And it was on Sockey Hall Street or just off it.
What's a tenement?
Huh?
What's a tenement?
A tenement, like multi freaking floor building. Gotcha. Like there's about 10 floors and bloody thing.
Flats.
And all these flats and things. Yeah. It was an awful place. It was freezing cold at night. And the landlady was as hard as nails. Like, you know, when two guys fell out one night in this place and one murdered the other. And there were four of us students at Stow College, and we all shared a double bed, two at the top and two at the bottom.
Jeepers.
And we used to go out and
four people in the bed.
Four people in the bed, aye. And we used to go out into her kitchen at night and secretly cook up meals because we were starving.
Oh, man.
Until one night one of the guys decided he was going to have a fry, and he pulled out the pan and all the saucepans fell on the floor, the big crash. And then we heard her shouting, "Who's out in my kitchen?" And we charged off into the bed, all pretending to be fast asleep, snoring away. She burst in, "I know it was you, you wee shit." And all this. And we were trying our best to stay asleep. And that was my first experience of going to sea. I went home again. Then I decided after that, I'm going to go and study for the priesthood.
Right.
But that only lasted about 3 years, and I thought, no, it's not for me.
Yeah.
So I came home again, got a job in the Dough Spinning Company as a translating German stuff, and not very well either. And then I decided, this is sickening my ass, and I decided I'm going to apply to the Royal Navy.
Wow.
So I applied to become an officer and a gentleman in the Royal Navy. That was a 3-day interview. There were like 2,000 applicants or something, and then they selected 100 out of that. And I went to Dartmouth Royal Naval College then for a while. So I stuck at Royal Navy for about 2 years. I just can't deal with all the mindless kind of obeying orders and barking orders. I couldn't do that.
Mm.
I can't do that. I'll give you a simple example. One of the exercises you had was when you'd be at sea, they would lower an 8-oar rowing boat thing over the side of the ship. And one cadet had to take charge of that. They dropped you into the sea in the middle of the Baltic or wherever, and you'd row around the ship. You'd hook on to the davits, and then they'd bring you back aboard again. And they timed it to see who was the fastest. And I took something like 45 seconds off the fastest time. Because I said to the guys, wow, look, I'm not going to be shouting at you lads. You all know what to do. I just call the stroke. And that meant keep the oars in time. That's all that meant. And I got sent for when we came up by the training officer. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get a big pat in the head here for this is good. And he brought me in and he says, what the f... I'm not allowed to swear here, but he said, what the F was that?
You're allowed to swear.
You can swear.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean? He said, what the fuck was that about there? He said, I couldn't hear one order from you. What sort of an officer doesn't give orders to his men? I said, sir, I had told them what I wanted them to do. I kept the stroke. They did what I wanted. What more do you want? That's not the way the Royal Navy does it. And I thought, that's it. Me and the Royal Navy will not go anywhere.
Wow. So I'm just reflecting back to you here, right? you kind of went your mom's way. You went down the road of religion, and that didn't work out. And then you went your dad's way, and that didn't work out.
Never thought of it like that yet.
And that's really good, because obviously our parents and the people that we're close to when you're young have such a big impact on us. Yeah. But there is that moment where you have to kind of figure out a third way.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's what it sounds like. That's what you were doing.
Yeah, and I ended up then going into teaching, because I loved working with kids and I love the whole idea of sharing things, you know. And then I applied to that and I got accepted to, it was at that time St. Joseph's Training College, it was called. It was part of, it's now part of Queen's, but, and I did science there. And there were only six of us doing science that year. And I got a job then in St. Mark's down at Warren Point as a science teacher. And then I ended up head of science down there, and I taught there for 26 years.
So, like, I expected you to go straight into the dog world after all that. 26 years?
Yeah, but dogs were always there. I mean, I was always working with dogs in my spare time, always. I mean, the first dog I ever was bitten by was Pete, that I tell about in the story in the book there. And he hated everybody except his owners, and he hated me too until, about going in and out. So Peggy Martin was our neighbour, and that was another experience, a spiritual experience I had as well. She was my neighbour, and she was lovely, Peggy and Kevin Martin. And they treated me like their son. And I was always, there were only three doors from where I lived, out in Rathcoole. And one day I was, anyway... Pete was this wee black and white sort of Scotty, and he was a real grumbly, grumpy wee bugger. He really was, like, and he hated me. But I kept at him and at him and at him. And then all of a sudden, one day, he just dropped the ball in front of me and let me play with him. That was the first time ever. Now he wouldn't have anything to do with anyone. And he and I became inseparable then, wee Pete.
Wow.
So, like, that was when I was about, I still had Trixie at that time, so I was alternating between Pete and Trixie. But what happened was, so I was then about, I suppose, about what, I grew up there and I was maybe 17. I was working at a scooter, a wee motor scooter I had, repairing a clutch cable. And I was in Peggy's garage, because we didn't have a garage. And I was working away at this, trying to get this clutch cable in, this Lambretta Starstream 125 it was. And it was such a difficult job for me because I'm thick. And I, in the middle of all this, I heard my mother calling me from across the gardens. "Neil," she shouts. And I said, "I'm coming, Mum. Hold on a second." And I carried on working and I heard her shouting again, really loud this time. "Mom, I'm coming. For God's sake, let me finish this." And then I carried on and then I heard her really shout at me. "Ah, for fuck's sake," said I. And I threw the tools down, went into Peggy, and I says, "Peggy, Mommy's called me down there. I don't know what she wants. I better go down and see what she wants." "That's all right." So I go down the road, open the door, and my ma's done ironing. And I says, "Mom, what do you want? What's wrong?" And she says, "What's wrong with you, boy?" And I said, "You're after calling me there. Three times you shouted at me." "I never called you," she said. "I didn't say a word to you." And with that, the phone rang. And my dad went and answered the phone, and he came in, his face white, and he says, "That's the Royal Victoria." He says, "So my sister Cynthia was having a baby, and apparently she was at death's door. The baby was spina bifida, and she had to be given an emergency cesarean, and she was at death's door, and the child was about to die." And they said, "They need us up there right away." And I thought, wow, shit, that's what that was about. Isn't that strange?
Wow. That's very strange. And it's interesting that a few of those experiences now that you shared have been to put you in the right moment during a crisis. So it's interesting that that's where you ended up being a lot of your life. How did you get into it professionally as such then? Into the dog world? You know, I don't know. Do you want to talk about Pepper or what's the best place to start with that?
Well, see, I was in the mountain rescue team, the Moor Mountain Rescue Team. I joined it when I was 73 or 4. And it was very small, made up of local climbers, guys like me who were doing rock climbing all the time, and shepherds and that. And we were searching this night for this guy.
What a crew. And rock climbers and shepherds.
Yeah, and
so biblical and hipster at the same time. It's unbelievable.
battering away through this freaking muck and gutters and stuff, looking for this wee man who's gone missing. And I remember thinking, I'm sure I could train a dog to do this. Hmm. It must be easier. There must be an easier way to do it. So I decided that's what I was going to do. And I went and spoke to the team leader at the time. He was Teddy Hawkins, a very grumpy, hard-to-know guy, like a brilliant mountaineer, but didn't suffer fools lightly. Like he really, and a very, very good team leader. I went and knocked timorously at his door one evening, and he opened and he says, yes. And I said, hiya, Teddy. Listen, so I was thinking of training the dog to help us to search for missing people at night. Did you? Do you know anything about dogs? And I said, well, yeah. And I know a fair bit, I suppose. And I didn't. I was stumbling. I really was struggling, like, because he's that sort of guy. And I felt really intimidated by him. And he says, well, how are you going to do it? And I said, well, I don't really know at this stage, but I'm going to have a go at it if that's okay with you. That's all right. Bang. And he shut the door. And that was the start of it.
That was your big initiation.
That was my initiation.
I don't give a toss. Slam.
Yeah. That was the moment you were knighted by this grumpy old kid. Yeah.
Like, it was desperate, you know. And then I thought, right, I want a German Shepherd. That's the only dog I could think of. And I had a friend called in the Cups called Joe Boyd. I don't know how I knew him from Newton Arch. Anyway, Joe said to me one day, oh, no, that's right. I wrote to the police at the RUC at the time, which for me as a Catholic living in sort of a very nationalist area was a very dangerous thing to do. But I thought, well, I'm doing it for the right reason. I want to help people.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, the Cops were very kind and they said, well, we'll send you this guy called Joe Boyd. You can work every Saturday with him and he'll teach you the ropes.
Wow, fair play.
And that's what they did. So I went down and worked with Joe and then he got me this German Shepherd eventually. He says, look, Neil, you have to come and see this guy here. He's called Kim. His nails are as long as my fingers. He's been totally neglected. He's like a scarecrow. He's been brutalized by this guy. But he said, you're the man for him. So I went and saw Kim, fell in love with him, took him home. And I thought, I'll train you now to be the first mountain rescue dog in Ireland. And I started training him. Hadn't a clue, really. Joe was guiding me. But it was all police-type training.
Yeah.
Finding somebody and then the dog stands barking at them. I thought, well, that'll do for now. And then by chance, I heard Hamish McGuinness in Scotland, who's a great mountaineer in Scotland. He was the leader of the Glencoe Mountain Rescue Team, had trained two shepherds, Rangy and Tiki, to do avalanche work, having seen what they were doing in Switzerland. And I wrote to him and I got a very nice response back. He invited me over to meet him.
Wow.
So I went to Glencoe. He lived in Ballyhoolish, just outside Glencoe. And we sat and had breakfast and he said to me, this is how you do, I did it and blah, blah, blah. So then I discovered that in Scotland there was a group called the Search and Rescue Dog Association. So I got in touch with them. And then they invited me to come and sort of have a look at what they do. And eventually then they accepted me into their ranks. So I trained away at Kimmy and brought him over. They put him through an assessment in Glencoe in an avalanche scene and said he was excellent, passed him, and that was your first initiation. And then you have to come back a year later to the Cairngorms and do a more advanced assessment, which I did. Mm. And he sailed through that, and that was the start of it.
Wow.
And that would be in the 70s.
Do I remember wrongly from your book that the first few dogs you tried to train in such a way they couldn't do the tasks? Did one of them have sheep eye or something? Did one of them have sheep eye?
Yeah, some of them did have. Kim did, actually, at the start.
Yeah, yeah.
What's sheep eye?
Sorry, Neil would
not explain. Staring at sheep, you know, or chasing sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So
explain the test.
Yeah. So he and I had a discussion, Kim and me. And I explained to him that you don't chase sheep, Kimmy, and if you do, you know, shit will fall upon your head from a great height. And he was a quick learner. He was safe with sheep. He was all right. But when you do sort of training, you are made, well, in Scotland not, but in the Lake District. I moved to the Lake District then. I started training my dogs there, going back and forward to the Lake District. they had a different, slightly different way of doing things to the way they did in Scotland, but just as professional, you know, really, really good, but it's different sort of techniques and stuff. But they would put your dog through a sheep test with a local farmer. And if he thought your dog had what they call sheep eye, where his dog was focused on the sheep, you would be instantly failed. You know, when everybody dreaded that test, but Kim passed it.
It's right at the end of all the training and assessments, isn't it? It's the last test, and it's like, what a waste of...
It could be. In those days, you could have wasted a year's training or 2 years' training, because once the dog took off after sheep, that was the end of it.
Yeah.
But he was good, you know, and Kim was good, but he had a very quick temper, and I discovered he'd bitten two people before I got him. I didn't know that.
Right.
But his last... search operation, he found the local GP who'd gone missing in the Mourns for 12 hours and he was badly hypothermic. And I knew his wife, and his wife rang me and asked me to help find him. And we went out in the mountains and Kim found him on the edge of a river, standing looking into the river. You know, he was just swaying. He didn't know where he was.
Perfect.
Now I remember he said, "Doctor, come away from the river. Come away. Fuck you. Who are you?" He says, and he knew me really well. And I said, look, you're good. Sit down here, will you? And such a lot of abuse. But anyway, we got some glucose into him and then he was fine. But that was the start of a journey that has lasted 40 years.
Wow. So that journey, there's a lot that's happened in there.
Oh, aye.
And so for the purposes of today, we were just saying, we're just going to throw out a few different situations and ask you to share a story or two around each of them.
Sure, yeah.
So the first one we wanted to cover was Lockerbie. What was Lockerbie?
Well,
what did your dogs do?
I was Pan Am. I've forgotten the
747. Pan Am 747.
It was Clipper of the Sea, and she had a bomb in it. Funny enough, when I was doing my PhD, Viva.
Yeah, it was terrorists.
When I was doing my PhD, Viva, the professor who was the lead said to me, "Neil, would you ever share something with us about your experiences with dogs, just to put you at ease?"
Yeah.
For your Viva, the Viva Voce, which is a vocal exam that you put you through for 2 hours about your research. Anyway, I said, "Yeah, I suppose it'd be the Lockerbie thing. Tell us about something that stands out in your mind from that." So the Lockerbie air crash was this Libyan guy had put a bomb in Germany somewhere. Into this jumbo jet, which was timed to explode over Scotland, and in fact it exploded over Lockerbie, and every passenger, all the crew and people on the ground were all killed. There was, I know, 270 or 300.
My
goodness.
Fatalities. No one survived. It happened just 2 days or 3 days before Christmas, and I had been seeing it on the news and the TV and stuff, and I rang my mates over there and said, "Look, do you need a hand?" So SARDA search dog people were all there searching for people out in Kielder Forest and all the surrounding areas and all that. And the guys invited me to come over. So it was Christmas Eve, I think. And I rang the police in Newcastle and said, "Look, I need to get to Lockerbie. How will I get there?" "Well, that's the big air disaster." "Yeah, right away. We'll see what we can do." And they rang me back and they said, "Right, can you get up to Aldergrove within the next 2 hours? We'll give you a police car escort." So they actually took me up in police car to Aldergrove, and there was a helicopter there.
Wow.
And I arranged for two other people from further north of here, Vicky and Cameron. They came with me. There were two dog handlers as well. I have a fear of flying. It's the first thing. And the first thing the guy who was briefing us said, "Look, we're going to be flying over the Irish Sea, so you have to put on immersion suits in case we ditch." And I thought, shit, what, seriously? And then he said, "Right, okay, and there's nothing to worry about." "Aye, right." So I'm getting this thing on me and put us into the helicopter anyway, so give us, and then took off, and it was at night, I remember flying over. And then when we arrived in Scotland, the pilot came on, and he said, "Right, there's Lockerbie dead ahead of us. Do you want us to fly you around the area to give you a sort of familiarization?" Now I'm dunging myself because I can't deal with a cut finger. And here I am going over to recover bodies and body parts. I remember saying to the good man above, look, this is what I meant to do. You're going to have to help me here because I can't do this. And that was all right. We landed in Lockerbie and the guy who met us who was in charge said, right, lads, do you want a cup of tea or anything like that? Or do you want to get stuck in? And I said, no, we'll get stuck in to hell with. So he took us down to the site. So I went down to Sherwood Crescent, which was where the fuselage had impacted. And I met one of my mates from Wales there, a fellow called Roland Leland, and he said, right, so you've got Pepper with you. And I said, yeah, has he ever done any work with dead bodies? No, hasn't a clue. He said, well, you see that hedge over there? And I looked across where he was saying, and there were all these like ribbons blowing in the breeze. Take him over there. He says, that's all human remains. Take him over there, get him used to that, and see if he's happy with that, and then we'll go from there. So I taught Pepper, find it, son, and taught him that that's what I wanted him to find, with a ball and all that. No bother, he switched on to it very quick, and then he says, right, if you make your way down to just down there, he said, and he pointed about 100, 200 yards away to where the crater was, and he says, go down there and talk to one of the cops, and he'll tell you what he wants you to do. So I met this young policeman standing on the edge of the crater, and the smell of aviation fuel was horrendous, really bad. Like, and I said, right, says I, this is Pepper here. And I said, he's a search dog. Where would you like me to start? And he's only a young lad. And he says, well, I don't know. He says, I suppose down there, indicating the crater, which is about 30 foot deep, and just mud, just an absolute shit fest of mud. It was horrendous. While he was telling me this, Pepper was digging at my feet, digging a hole, frantically digging. What the hell's wrong with him? And I asked one of the guys for a fork. So I helped him and I dug away down, and up comes this half a torso, and a head, chest, everything, all completely plasticine, like it was just featureless. And the young policeman said, oh, Jesus, beside me. And then I said, well, what are we going to do? Here's a bag. We'll get this person into the... And such dignity and respect that was shown, magic. I was telling the professor this, Queens, and I burst into tears. Couldn't talk. Oh, no. That was really part of it. That was part of it. I'll tell you the rest in a second. So anyway, so we get that poor fella or person into this bag. Meanwhile, Pepper goes down between two walls that had collapsed. And he came out with an arm in his mouth, you know, just the radius and the ulna, just the bones and the hand and all that. And I thought, fuck me. And that was the next thing. So we spent time in there, and I was telling the professor then at Queen's. So we went out there and we were searching Kildare Forest, and Pepper came out of the forest at one point with a red high heel shoe in his mouth. And he sat in front of me with this shoe, and I took it off him, and I was standing there looking at it. I turned it over and I saw it was a size 6. I'll never forget that. And I thought to myself, there's a young girl who's been wearing this. You know, who was she? And what's her mum and dad going to think? And blah, blah, blah. It was all this. And then I ended up getting really upset. And wee Pepper jumped out must to say, like, come on, dad, let's carry on.
Yeah.
You're right, son. And I told the professor this at Queen's. This is all before my PhD viva. I ended up in floods of tears. I couldn't speak. Because of that red high heel shoe, that personalised what I was doing. Up to then, it was totally impersonal.
Yeah,
I got the strength that I had asked for to do what I was doing. I mean, Jesus, like it was just amazing what I was able to do. And we were finding, well, I won't go into the detail, but anyway, it went on for 5 days. And then we came home. And when I came home, my wife and all, they had kept Christmas back for me, like, so Christmas dinner. And my sister-in-law was there. And I remember her saying to me, Neil, at one point, Neil, what was it like? And that was it. I had to walk out. I couldn't talk about it, right? For 3 years, I was thinking I was going mad because I would blow up the slightest provocation. I was very emotional. I couldn't smell fumes from a central heating boiler because it reminded me of the Avgas. Cracked up. And there was a song I had heard on the radio, Softly As I Leave You Now. It was a male voice choir. I couldn't listen to that song without ending up floods of tears. Yeah. And I thought, fuck me, I'm losing it. And then I decided, somebody asked me, would you train as a counsellor? And I said, why would I want to do that? Marriage guidance counsellor, and you'd be the right man for that. I'd fuck off. Like, what do I know about that? No. And but I said, okay. And I went away and I did this training as counsellor. And then an opportunity came to go to Queen's and do my math. Now, I'd already got my basic degree through in science and that. To go and do a master's at Queen's in counselling, guidance and counselling for youngsters. And so I did that, 3-year part-time, or was it 2 years? Can't remember. A wonderful course. There were 16 of us in the so each year, the top eight would move on and the new eight would come in. So there was always 16. Very secure, safe place. And the professor said to us one day, She says, she was Ruth Leach, a wonderful professor at Queen's, and she said, I want you all, and I'm not touchy-feely, and I can't get into all this emotional stuff and all that. I want you all to imagine you're a tree. And picture yourself now as a tree, and I want you to just put your pencil on the paper and let your pencil express your subconscious mind and draw whatever it is you feel that you are. What a load of crap, I'm thinking to myself. And I just said, Neil, I notice you haven't done anything, she says. And I said, right, Ruth, I'm sorry. And I just put my pencil on the paper and it started to draw two fir trees, right? And they were on a hill. And the higher tree was intact. The lower tree was broken off at the top and was leaning against the other tree. And I hit it. And she says, I want somebody to volunteer to put their drawing up on the board and we can discuss it. And I made sure mine was well hidden. Neil, can I see yours? She said. And she pulled mine out from under the things and put it up on the board. Now, she says, could you like to explain that? Why were there two trees? I don't know, Ruth. She says, think, she says, why are there two trees? For example, who's this? What's this here? And I says, well, I suppose that's me and that'll be my wife. Why is she higher than you? And I remember saying, genuinely saying, well, she's a better person than me. What do you mean by that? Well, I rely on her for everything. And so that's very nice. And she said, tell me, what traumatic experience did you have 3 years ago? She specified 3 years ago.
Wow.
And I thought, what? I don't know. What? Something really traumatic in your life. And I said, well, I suppose it was the Lockerbie air crash because that was 3 years previous. She had measured the tree somewhere. Well, it's a technique that you use. Greg Firth is the guy who would have led this. It's called art therapy, and it's a way of unlocking the subconscious mind, basically. And she said, tell us about your experience in Lockerbie. And then I just unloaded it all in the security of that group. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I was able to deal with some horrendous situations, like 4 earthquakes I've been at a helicopter crash with body parts all over the place, and I was able to deal with it all thanks to that course in counselling and Ruth Leach.
Wow.
Deep breath.
That's insane.
I do dog training. I do dog behavior work. So I just have this ability with dogs. I think we're all given gifts of one sort or another. And I think I've been given this gift to work with dogs. I just think that that's the case. And dogs, aggressive dogs, I can work with aggressive dog and they'll come over to me and they do the usual sort of snottering and slobbering and teeth and all that. And then before I know it, they're sitting beside me and they're okay. Mm. Most of them, like I have been bitten, but most of them are good. But I found when I'm dealing with difficult, really difficult, challenging dogs, very often I find I'm using my counselling skills. People are asking me, you know, well, it's this has happened or that has happened, and then I can use those skills. Yeah. And so it's what I said at the start. We're meant to follow certain paths, you know.
Mm. I remember you saying, sorry to interrupt, buddy. I remember you saying, years ago when I was talking to you, it was something like the, if you want a dog to do arson detection or you want a dog to do cadaver recovery, it's not about just getting a dog and saying, I'm going to train you. It's finding out what the dog naturally wants to do, because some dogs don't like caustic
smells.
Yeah,
there's a lot of truth in that, yeah.
And you're saying it's that, we'll get on to epilepsy.
But that's in the professional side of dog training, you know, but like, I deal with dog behavior issues where we dogs are just being knobs, you know. You know, and there's it's a 2-hour session usually, but inevitably you will find when you talk to the people and you're watching the dog, and I can see up to now, thank God, I've been able to see where the issues are and give them a wee strategy for making them better.
Yeah,
and I just love doing that.
So I've got it now. We're trying to figure out what title he has. It's canine counseling.
Yeah, there it is. That's made in America, you could become a millionaire with a title like that.
A canine counselor. Yeah.
You can go to like all the rich Beverly Hills people and like train their chihuahuas.
All the chihuahuas. All the handbag chihuahuas.
Yeah, look, I was doing like, I could be doing it sort of 5 days a week, 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested. I do 3 days a week. I do, like, I'll do 1 a day.
Yeah.
And I genuinely think, you know, that that's the need at the minute, but I'm getting too old.
Did you meet your boy Caesar?
Yeah, I met him twice. Caesar Milan. Caesar Milan. Yeah,
what was the show? I remember that. I watched that as a boy.
It was the Dog Whisperer.
That's what it was.
Caesar's very talented. You know, well, there's two schools of thought about Caesar, that he's brutal in the way he deals with dogs. I do know he would use techniques maybe that would be frowned on, but I see what he does with dogs, and I've met him. He's a very gentle, very nice man. And he's gifted with really difficult dogs. Dogs that are going to be put to sleep because they're so aggressive, he will get round. But the other school of thought is that he is brutal and people don't like him. There were 2 papers written on him. But I personally have a lot of time for Caesar Milan.
Yeah. So there's a long list here and time is escaping us. You mentioned the earthquakes, the underwater detection you did. You mentioned before about the scent rising to the top of the water, which I think is interesting. Pirated DVDs. Can you give me a wee bit on that?
Well, the Motion Picture Association of America are a group which oversees or tries to protect the rights of MGM and Pathé News and all the Disney and all this from piracy. So as soon as a new film comes out, within 24 hours, virtually, it'll be pirated. In those days, and the hub for that was Malaysia at that time. And the head of the Motion Picture Association of America wanted to know if it was possible to train 2 dogs to detect hidden DVDs. So they asked another great dog, a trainer friend of mine, Davey Mabry, who worked for the Motion Picture Association over here. He would sort of go into pubs and stuff and make sure that their licensing, they were complying with all the licensing laws and all that, overshown movies and stuff. And Davey asked me, was it possible? Would you be interested in trying this? So I thought, well, why not have a go? And I happened to be working with this character. I won't name the character, but anyway, he breeds dogs, and he was asking me to teach him how to train dogs to find stuff. So I said, look, you've got a couple of Labradors there that are not being used for anything, but I think they've got great potential as such dogs. Let's work with these and I'll teach you as I go along. And what we'll do is see if there's an odour that's detectable to the dogs from optical discs, which are DVDs. So I used various techniques to find that. And then I eventually was able to hide these DVDs in cupboards, drawers, whatever, and the dogs were finding them and indicating. And the way they would indicate that to find them, they would just sit there and point with their noses at the source of the odour. And I rang Davey Mabry up and I said, Davey, there's definitely an odour off DVDs and we've cracked it. And he says, how do you know there's an odour off DVDs? And I said, because every time I hide them, no matter where I hide them, whether it's 1 or 1,000, the dogs find them. Wow. But he says, how do you know it's the DVDs? Well, what else is it going to friggin' be? And he said, well, it could be the labels that stuck onto the DVDs.
The glue,
could be the packaging, the glue, whatever. You need to get better results than that. So I went back to the drawing board. Anyway, the long and short of it was, I find there is an odor off optical disc. It's polycarbonate. So the Motion Picture Association head man decided he would come to London to test these two yogs that I had trained. There was him, his deputy, a man called Glickman, and there was two guys from the Customs and Excise and a film crew. And they brought me to Stansted Airport, and they said, there's a plane that's just landed from Malaysia. Here's the cargo coming off it on this conveyor belt. See if you can find DVDs. Hundreds of packages and boxes. So I put Lucky and Flo with the two dogs, and I put Lucky up onto the conveyor belt. She'd never been on a conveyor belt in her life. So she's trying to keep pace, you know, just walking on the conveyor belt, checking these boxes they were passing her. She nailed one, I lifted it off, nailed another one, lifted it off, lifted her off. And then the customs guy said, right, well, let's see how good she is. So he opened the first box up, and there was all these tins, and I looked at these tins, and he says, sorry, mate, he says, tins of dog food. She's finding dog food. And I said, are you sure about that? Check. So he lifted out all the tins, and there at the bottom was one DVD. Now, it was a genuine wow. marketing DVD, but it was a DVD nonetheless.
For the dog food, like a marketing.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So then he says, well, we'll open the second box. And he opened the second box, and it was a much bigger box. And it was full of counterfeit trainers, right? But when he lifted all the trainers out, there was another layer. And here was hundreds of child pornography stuff, all in DVD form. And they were blown away. And I, as a teacher, I was responsible then as well in the school. One of my jobs was if a child had been abused or sexually abused or physically or whatever, or there was a suspicion of that, it was my job then to liaise with the child protection team in Newry and see that the child was safeguarded, you see. So I had a particular interest in preventing this going around the world, this horrible stuff going around the world on DVDs. So anyway, that was that. So they were blown away, and then they invited me then to go to, so I was flown around the world. I was flown to Washington, New York, Los Angeles, Toronto, Dubai, Hong Kong, and all of these places where I was demonstrating the two dogs. Mm-hmm. They ended up then, all the different customs and excise people were totally blown away by this. So they ended up being taken to Malaysia. And I wasn't able to go with them, so Davy went. And I think they found, within the first day, 2.5 million quid's worth of hidden pirated DVDs behind a false wall.
Wow.
And then there was a hit by the bad dudes on the two dogs of grand each to do away with them. Yeah. And so the two of them had to be flown out there in an emergency then. So then I was allowed to train two more dogs. Asked to train two more dogs, Paddy and Manny. I trained them. They went to Malaysia, and within 4 weeks, Manny had been killed by the guys who were doing the piracy. Yeah. And the other wee dog, I don't know what happened to Manny. And I had been promised I'd be able to keep Lucky and Flo whenever they retired. But that never happened. And I actually never knew what happened to them.
Mm. There is, as a side note, a specific dog that I cannot mention. He was responsible for breaking a massive pedophile ring in America because of a USB flash drive that he found.
Mm.
That dog is linked to you as well, just so you know. So there's a big legacy that you're talking about how much it means to you.
Yeah.
It's on your heart.
That's wonderful.
There's another great magical story that you have been a part of.
Since then, you know, if you go onto Wikipedia or something and you put in Lucky and Flo, you'll see that this guy in England apparently was the first in the world to have trained this dog, this type of dog. People do that. You know, if you get an idea. Like, I've had so many people have come to me in my life and said, would you teach me how to do this or do that? And I would share anything with anyone. And all of a sudden, before you know it, they're the experts and you're thrown to one side, you know. And
that's happened to you a lot, Neil.
Yes, it has.
So that was one of my hearts for wanting to tell your story originally, was because that's happened a lot to you. And it really sucks.
Yeah, you get screwed. People, if you're willing to be friendly and share things, people, there are people out, not all, but there are people out there who will see that as a weakness. And as a way to get a leg up at your expense.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's just human nature, I suppose.
Kind of, you can stay on that topic or you can take us somewhere else. One of the questions I love asking people is, what has been your most important failure?
Failure?
Yeah.
I can't really answer that because I don't see anything that I've done as a failure.
Love that.
Really, I genuinely don't. Where I have tried to preach to it and it didn't work out, I learned from that. I benefited an awful lot. I remember, when I came out of the seminary, the first time I had a job as a lifeguard down in Butlins, and I used to go every morning to the chapel, 6 o'clock, whatever it was, and I'd say a few prayers, and then I'd go down to work. And this day I went there as usual, and then I headed off down to work, and I got this overwhelming feeling that I needed to go back. And I went back to the chapel again. I just knelt down, I was looking at the tabernacle, and all of a sudden I felt a strange feeling coming over the top of my head, like tingling. I went right through my body, and I just felt totally ecstatic, total sense of absolute ecstasy. And then just as soon as that, it drained away again. And I was just looking at a tabernacle thing. And I walked out down the camp thinking, what the hell was that? What was that about? And that was over 40 years ago. You could have said I was a failure because I came out of the priesthood, but it wasn't. I think on reflection, leaving the Royal Navy probably was. Because I was severely bullied by this senior officer. You go to sea, you learn all the basic navigation, and you come back and you do some short time back at the college. And he used to pick me out every Sunday morning when you do parade, where you parade there in your best uniform. And the guys knew he was picking on me. And they would go over my uniform with sellotape, make sure there wasn't a mark on it. And this guy used to pull me. And one day he was so abusive, I fainted. And I was brought up before the commanding officer of Dartmouth and told that I lacked, what was the moral fibre? You are LMF, lacking in moral fibre. And I decided that was it, I'm off. And the Navy decided it was it as well. And that really stung me more than anything. That would have been my, even though when we were going across the Bay of Biscay in a Force 12 storm, huge mountainous seas, and the officer of the watch said, I need a volunteer to go up to the bow to shut a hatch, it's an air intake. The seas are pouring down the hatch and into the forward mess decks. Could somebody volunteer to go up and do that? This was at night. And he said, Paddy, you'll do it. And he pulled me out. And no life jacket, safety line, nothing, right? Yeah. He says, tell me when you're ready, he says, and I'll slow the ship down. And I had to go down this ladder, in underneath the gun turret, and wait for the seas to break over me, and then run to the first breakwater, and then the second breakwater, until I got right into the bow of the ship, shut the hatch, and then back again. Even though I was able to do that, you were considered not have moral fibre enough to be a Royal Naval officer. And I thought that was the biggest failure. Definitely.
That's a lie, first of all. You're one of the most full of moral fibre people I know. How do you phrase that? Moralistically fibreless.
HMF, high moral fibre.
Your HMF. that must have been... Yeah,
that's the answer to your question.
That must have been a real kick for you in the manhood pants as well, because that's a huge authority figure in your life.
It was really hard to take. Even now, I sort of feel sorry about that, and I think it was unjust.
Yeah.
Totally. And I didn't get any support. Nowadays, things are much better, but in those days, you got no support at all.
Yeah.
You know?
But I'm glad it sounds like it's your most important, because, the impact you've had is astronomical and through the dogs, through the work you've done there. You probably wouldn't have got onto that if it wasn't for them.
You pushed yourself harder because of that, maybe, to prove yourself or something?
Well, see, one of the things that we used to do with the dogs, in the old days, the dogs stood and barked at the casualty whenever they found him. And I reckon that this is silly, because I couldn't hear my dog because he'd be half a mile from me and the wind howling and all that. And I remember saying to the guys in Scotland who were then, I was working with them, saying to the training officer there, Bill Meakey, I said, look, Bill, I'm sure I could train this dog to come back, bark at me, and then take me to the person. Mm-hmm. No, that's impossible. And straight away, when somebody says it's impossible, I thought, I'm going to do this. And yeah. I did do it, yeah. And I demonstrated it. And it's now, that's the technique that's that the they technique, use all yeah. over the world now.
You invented that. Yeah, yeah. I love that.
Well, I'm not saying I'm the only one. There could have been somebody else somewhere else in the world.
I hear
it.
Yeah.
But I don't know of anybody at the time yeah. who was doing it, you know. But.
Tell me, remind me of this fantastic story about the guy. You all went looking for this guy.
And he
the funniest story. Tell that story. I love
tramping around the mountains at night, searching for this guy for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And this is before I had the dogs. And it was pissing rain, and you were covered in gutters and falling flat in your face and all. And the guy's name was, we'll say, Michael O'Shea for the sake of argument. And he was 36.
Very specific.
Tramping along. And then we all decided to take a break. And then somebody noticed this guy was with us that wasn't a member of the team, and somebody said, how you doing, boy? Where'd you come from? I says, I thought I'd give you a hand here. I see you're searching for somebody. And what's your name? Michael O'Shea. For fuck's sake, this is the guy we've been looking for 3 or 4 hours in the pitching rain, helping us to look for himself.
I love that.
Secret heart of God.
That's one of my favorite stories from your
That's genuine.
Your book. That's good. Okay, so I'm going to push into that, kind of the main topic that's on my heart about just, you know, manhood, masculinity, that kind of stuff. I just want to ask you, when is it that boys become men? Is it a moment? Is it a period of growth? What do you think? What do you remember the moment when you first felt like, I'm a man?
I suppose the first time I really knew it was when my dad said to me one time, you know, your sister's in hospital having the baby and you're out there. I had a job working at the Europa Hotel, driving people around at night. I was a night porter, and I had just come home from a night shift at 2 a.m. or something like that to be confronted with my dad, given out to me because I hadn't paid enough attention to my sister who was in hospital. That was the time I was telling you about. And I had just been shot at that night. Two guys in West Belfast tried to take the van off me, and I remember the bullets sparking off the road as I was driving down the road. And then I nearly hit by one of these big armoured car things, the big pigs, they call them.
Pigs, yeah.
And I remember losing my temper. My dad losing his temper with me and grabbing me by the throat. And I remember drawing my fist back and said, don't you ever hit me again or threaten me again. And my poor mother, distraught. And I thought, Jesus, this is not the way to be. This is not the way to be. It was all the stress and all the rest of it that caused that. Is that being a man? I don't know. It was standing up for myself. Yes, that was it.
Yeah.
That was the first time I really stood up for myself.
I think I said the same thing, wasn't it? The first time I stood up for myself.
Yeah, and it was to your dad as well.
Yeah.
What I like about that story is it was the holding back of the punch.
Yeah.
Oh, I would never hit my dad. No. Ever. No matter what he had done.
There's something really like abhorrent about that hitting your parent thing.
Oh yeah, I couldn't do it.
Because I remember feeling that too. I remember saying to you, like, I felt shame mm-hmm. in the moment.
I still feel shame.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of judo in my day, and I mm-hmm. fought for the Navy and as a judo player. Yeah.
What guy did you bring in today? This guy is unbelievable.
You know, and I knew I could have really hurt my dad if I'd wanted to, yeah. and I had no intention of ever doing that to my dad. And I loved him dearly underneath it all, you know, but he was a hard man.
You're maybe a good man to ask this question too. I was having a really interesting conversation with a friend over the weekend. We were out for a hike and we were discussing what does it mean to honour your father and mother. You were almost a priest. Can you have a stab at it?
I'd honour my father. Well, I always showed my mum and dad respect. Always. Whatever they asked me to do, I would do it. If I didn't want to do it, I would try to get out of it, but I always ask him. But Daddy was very hard with his hands. Like, if you stepped out of line, you got some walloping. But I would never disrespect my mum and dad ever. Mm. You know, my mother did everything for me. So did my dad. Like, he brought me, when I wanted to go to the sea, he brought me over to Glasgow and he stayed with me there for 2 or 3 days. And whatever I wanted to do, they supported me, whether it was to go to the sea or be the priest or whatever. They always supported me. And Daddy left me in this YMCA place till I could get somewhere to stay. And there was this man he met there, and he said, look, I have to go back home to Ireland. He said, would you keep your eye on our Neil and make sure he's okay? And oh, certainly, I'll do that. And the following night, knock on the door. This man was there. It was about 1 a.m, and I was writing a letter to my mom and dad. I was sitting in my bed, and he came in, and he sat on the edge of the bed, and he turned out to be a paedophile. Yeah. And I was only, 17, something like that. And I remember him trying to force himself on me. And I had a glass of water on the side of my bed, and I grabbed the glass, and I said, you come anywhere closer to me now, and I'm going to bury this into your face. You can't threaten me like that. He said, I'm going to make a complaint. And if you complain to the management, he said, it's your word against mine, and I've been here for 5 years. Who do you think they're going to believe? Sakers. That was my introduction to the real world.
Mm.
And I thought, what a betrayal. What a betrayal. Do you know?
Yeah, the darkness of the world, yeah.
There is so much to talk about. I think it's really interesting, and I think it's really important that you had strength. What I mean by that is you knew you could defend yourself.
Yeah.
You knew you could fight back, whether it was to your dad or to this man. And, you know, obviously with your dad, you had that beautiful sparring moment, which I think was right for you to do. I think so many young guys, so many men in general, no matter how old they are, they don't have that physical confidence. And I think that's something that we're missing.
Where do they get that from is the question.
I don't know. With me, it was martial arts. Like doing judo, I used to go to Shankill Road, I think it was. There was a judo club there. And I loved it. I absolutely loved doing judo, playing judo. I was never brilliant at it, like, but I really enjoyed it. But yeah. I knew enough. I knew that I could defend myself if I had to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have that physical confidence when I was a kid. So I started doing martial arts about 11-ish, jiu-jitsu.
Jiu-jitsu is brilliant.
In Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Remind me of this. Is there something to... Did I once remember you telling me there's a statue related to you, your family, or something in Cork, and yes, I went and got a picture.
Cove. I'm from Cove originally, yeah.
Yes, I got a picture.
Yeah, my Uncle Frank was he was in the Harbour Protection Group. He was like ships during the war. And he would also go out with the pilot launch to put the pilot on the ships coming in and out of Cork Harbour. Yeah. And this night, one of the Irish shipping line, I think it was the Irish Elm. Yeah, she was going out to sea. And they went out to take the pilot off. And normally the ship would slow down. They obviously slowed down to transfer the pilot, but they would remain at the sort of a slow speed until the pilot launch got clear. But this night, for whatever reason, they didn't, and they steamed ahead. And my uncle and these three crewmen were pulled underneath the propeller, and they were all killed.
Yeah.
So there's a statue in Cove to his memory, Frank Powell.
Because I remember texting you and saying, I found the statue. I got a picture of it as we were there. Right. My brother and sister live down there in Cork. And we went out for a meal in Cove. I remember going, I think I'm in Cove. I think this is where Neil's from. I think that's the statue he mentioned.
I got
a picture.
Good find,
I sent it to you.
Yeah.
It was a lovely moment.
Neil, starting to land the plane. A couple more questions, then we're out of here.
All right.
If you could bring back one of your dogs, which one would you bring back?
Oh, God. I couldn't answer that.
Okay, sorry. Don't want to put you in that position.
No. They were all, every single one of them was wonderful. Every single one of them.
Mm.
Yeah.
I like how you talk about them.
I can't think, you know, I they're like little characters that are still around me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe. Dogs are to me are just pure love, you know, unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept that there is a God of love, I think that they all take a bit of that love, that massive love bubble that's in the sky, whatever it is. And I think love never dies.
Hmm.
You know, it's always there. It'll go back to love. We'll go back to love kind of thing. And I think the dogs are always there, you know. And they've been wonderful. Every single one of them has been wonderful little character.
One of the biggest regrets in my life is that my granddad died when I was young. He died, I was maybe 4, maybe 5. But he's a dog breeder. And he was a hunting man. And I'm a real soft city boy, like.
Yeah.
And he was out shooting and, you know, like winning clay pigeon competitions and all this sort of stuff. I found a, I don't know if it was a plaque or a trophy or something from Hugh. And he had won a competition and it was like 99 out of 100 clay pigeons. What type of a monster was this guy? You know, tough guy, would have fought with people, had a motorbike and all this sort of stuff. But I think, you know, it would have been interesting to see how my life would have turned out differently if he was still there. I guarantee you I would be a few more calluses on my hands probably.
Yeah. But we are who we are because of who we are. Do you know what I mean? You get steered by the people that you meet, the people that you meet in your life, you know, as casually. And the odd word here or there, like somebody smiled at me one day and I thought, well, what a nice thing to do, you know. Just thanking me for letting them cross the road or something like that. I thought, you know, that's nice.
Yeah. If you could go back in time, say to, an 18-year-old version of yourself, to young Neil, Neil.
Yeah.
And you had a few minutes of his time, what sort of things would you say to him?
Just do what you think you should do and don't be put off by anyone. You know, you seek advice, yes, ask people for advice. But if you think you want to do something, go and do it. Just go and do it. I mean, what am I doing a PhD at my time of life for? And yet I thought I need to do this because I believe I owe it to people who have, well, in this case, epilepsy, to use the talents that I have working with dogs to be able to help those people in some way. And that's what drove me to do it. And battered my way through 5.5 years of real hard work at Queen's to get my PhD at my time of life.
It's amazing.
You know, I don't need to do that, but I just felt I have to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what would have motivated me through all those hours of sitting there, 12 hours a day like you'd be doing, writing your stuff up and all that. But,
and the epilepsy one, explain that one to us again. This was a dog.
It's about the fact that dogs, family pets, are able to predict epileptic seizure onset or diabetic highs and lows or Addison's disease, which is a drop in cortisol, or in some cases, post-traumatic stress disorder issues. They can predict those.
Wow.
And I was interested in that. And I did a survey, went around the world. Do you have epilepsy? Yes. Do you have a pet dog that's untrained? Yes. Does he ever predict your seizures? Yes. How does he do it? He does it by staring at me, by touching me, or by barking at me. How long before a seizure would he do this? Anything from 5 minutes to an hour.
Wow.
And I thought, right, that's it. So I have to find a way of proving whether this is true or not. So I got 20 untrained dogs, local dogs from Glen Craig Dog Training Club, which is Michael McCartney in Lisburn. 20 dogs from there, nothing to do with epilepsy. And I had to find a way of delivering to the owners an odor that the dog would recognize as a seizure odor. So I developed this device, which is called a remote odor delivery mechanism. It doesn't really matter what, it's just a basic way of delivering odor. So an owner would sit in the middle of the laboratory and his dog would be allowed to wander around the laboratory at random. But unknown to the dog, there were two little pipes coming from another laboratory, one under one leg, one under the other leg. They would randomly pump out the odor of a seizure or the odor of a non-seizure, just scent from a person. As soon as the dog detected the odor of seizure, he reacted in the same way that these people around the world were telling me. Because I thought, well, if these are untrained dogs doing this naturally, surely if I take 20 untrained dogs, I'm bound to see the same behavior.
Yeah.
If I expose them to what they think is their owner about to have a seizure. And sure enough, that's what happened. So I was able to detect from that that epilepsy gives off an odor which the dogs will detect in a way that causes them to demand attention from their owners for some reason. That part I don't know why. But I also don't believe that it's epilepsy per se that has an odor. I think that any physiological condition like hypo or hyperglycemia or epilepsy create a physiological stress odor in the body, which we breathe out. And that stress odor is what the dogs are reacting to. So my postdoctoral work is about proving that to be the case or trying to get evidence to support that view. So there's two types of seizure. There's epileptic seizure and there's psychogenic non-epileptic seizure. Both look the same, but they're completely different basis. And yet dogs are reacting to the same, in the same way to both types of seizure, which science up to now has dismissed. They've said, well, we're not interested in non-epileptic seizures and the way the dogs react to them because that's not epilepsy. That's nonsense to me. Why are the dogs doing it? Why? What is it about that type of seizure that evokes the same behavior? So that's what my research now is about. And I'm working with the neurology department at in the Belfast Trust to try to work out what that is. Dr. John Craig and Michael Kinney are the two consultant neurologists there, and we're working together on this.
Incredible. Exciting.
Class.
Really it is, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Search Dogs and Me, Neil Powell. The link to his website will be in the description wherever you're listening to or watching this. Young Neil, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure, lads. Thank you.
Really incredible.
Plugger also for SARDA.
Oh, the Search and Rescue Dog Association, yeah. Ireland North, yeah. It's a charity that trains dogs for missing people. We train dogs to find people on the mountains, under the water. So the dog works from a boat to detect the underwater odor. Or a clap structure, we would work with the fire service. And we have two dogs trained to work with the fire service. They were at Creaselock recently as well, searching for people there.
Amazing. Thanks, Si. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you for listening. Yeah. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, guys.